Hi, I'm Joette, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Anna. I want to thank the Roundup Committee for inviting me. I've been coming to the Roundup for 20 years. This is my favorite conference. I've seen some of the speakers that are the rock stars to me today, that I listen to their CDs over and over in my car. They were their cassettes at one time, and now they're the CDs. And I am so honored to be here, and I know this is one of the hardest working committees I've ever seen, and I really appreciate your efforts, so thank you for all you do. All right, my name's Joette. I'm an alcoholic. Yes. My sobriety date is March 10th, 1997. I have a home group. It's the First Things First Women's Group at the Serenity House in Buford, Georgia. Is my tribe in the house? I have a sponsor. Her name's Vanessa B., and she's been loving me unconditionally for 17 years. I have to tell you, I am so nervous. And last night I was in my car, in my garage, talking to my sponsor, which I do. I spend a lot of time in my car, in my garage, talking on the phone to sponsees and my sponsor. And I was flying apart. I was in tears. And I just kept saying, why do I have to do this? This is so hard. There must be a mistake. She reminded me gently, like she always does, that God doesn't make mistakes and that it was going to be okay, and there was a reason to be here. And I have a message, and I can carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. This morning I got up and I run in the woods. I trail run. So I go out, and I have probably 1,500 praise and worship songs on my iPod. I've been collecting them for many years. And I only really listen to them for a short period of time. So, I mean, years can go by before they shuffle through and I hear the same song twice. And a song came on the moment I headed out into the woods. And it's a Misty Edwards song. And she said, or the lyrics are from God. I knew what I was getting into. I knew what I was getting into when I brought you here. And there is no mistake. And I fell to my knees and I sobbed. I got up and I ran, because believe me, it's not the first time I've run through tears. And I relaxed. And I knew that I can do this. I can do this. So I'm grateful that there are so many familiar faces here today. All right, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And generationally speaking, I'm from really good German farm people. They're super smart, hardworking, godly people. And I'm not sure what happened with my mom. Okay? She wrestled under the delusion that she could, or she labored under the delusion that she could wrest satisfaction out of this world if only she managed well. And her solutions were always worse than her problems. We spent the first 9 years of my life in Milwaukee, close to my grandmother and my relatives, and a lot of time with my cousins. But from the very beginning, my younger sister and I came from a lot of neglect. I was 6 and she was 4 when my mom left us alone at home. She'd go to work at night. I don't remember a time when she woke up before 2 or 3 in the afternoon. We were alone and unsupervised most of the time. When I was 9, we moved to Cincinnati. She moved us to a place where we had no friends and no family, and it was described as an Appalachian ghetto in a book I read once. And it's just a lot of poor white trash. My mom continued to work nights, and we were left unsupervised. And our experience there was of abuse, neglect, and poverty. And the kind of neglect where she'd go to work and not have adequate childcare, and lock us in our bedroom and leave for the evening. The kind of poverty was welfare, hungry, poor. One pair of shoes that lasted all year long. No car. Not for a long, long time. Not really any furniture. We sat on a rolled-up carpet for years in our apartment. That was our couch. And it looked like that. And the abuse was, you know, what you hear about. Verbal, physical abuse. A lot of broken wooden spoons and paint stirrers. I'd like to say, I'm just going to let that go. I do want to tell you this, and I was asked not to make a lot of notes, but there were some things that I wanted to write down that God gave me in the last couple days, and I really think this is important because this is what I got here with. As a result of growing up in that lifestyle, there were some truths evident in my life. One of them was that neglect breeds self-sufficiency. Abuse breeds an inability to trust people in authority. And that poverty breeds a lack mentality. I developed some real specific tools for living and some fundamental ideas about myself. Trust no one. Might is right. Lie till you die. And if I want it, I'm going to have to steal it. I believed I was unlovable. I was loud, stupid, and unattractive, and I would never be enough. And by the time I was 11, there were a couple of real important things that had happened to me. One of them was my father, who took off when I was 2. I'd only seen him a couple times. We got a phone call that he died. He was a drug dealer, apparently, and he was trying to straighten out his life. And he went to work with my grandfather as a pipe fitter, and he fell on the job. And they called and let us know that he had passed away. And now I'll have to tell you, as a small child living in that abusive, neglectful, hellish, really, childhood, I would fantasize about my dad coming on his white horse, knocking down the apartment door, and saying, come on, girl. Okay, wait, not girls, all right, because I was selfish and self-centered from day one, all right? I can tell you I was not worried about my little sister. The fantasy went like this. My dad would ride in on his white horse, knock down the apartment door, and say, pack your bags, Joette. You're going home. So the day we got the phone call, the gates of hell clanged shut in my mind. I was hopeless and abandoned there. The other thing that happened when I was 11 is I took my first drink. This neighborhood I lived in had a lot of kids who were unsupervised and abused and neglected, and all of their parents drank and used and smoked. So we would steal from our parents and run off into our fort in the woods. And there were kids anywhere from 19 to my sister, who was 9. And we'd just share whatever we had. And although alcohol for me eventually became the power I needed to cope, it gave me the ability to feel smart and pretty, competent, funny. Initially, what it did for me was churn down the screaming monkeys that were living in the trees in my head at that time. And it turned down the volume. And I drank essentially for the effect that alcohol produced in me from that day on. Now, when you're 11 years old, you pretty much get what you can take. It was easy to steal money from my mom and walk down to the corner store and get the local drunk to buy me a bottle of Boone's Farm or whatever he was drinking, you know, and I drank it. I took whatever you had. And there was always something. By the time I was 14, I was fighting back with my mom. Now, my sister was the other personality. She would hide under the table. I fought back. And by the time I was 14, every single day we were fist fighting, hair pulling, scratching, fighting, screaming before I'd get on the bus at 7 o'clock in the morning. It was every day. And I was defiant, dishonest, destructive. I was stealing from the local drugstore. I was stealing out of my mom's purse. I was out of control, and she just got tired, so she threw me out. I was homeless for about a summer, slept on a bunch of couches until my grandmother and my aunt called and said, "You need to come up here." I moved to northern Wisconsin. I was 14. I was going into the 10th grade. And I don't know what caused my aunt and uncle to bring me into their home. They have 5 children of their own. I know this, they were good people. My uncle was a good man. He loved his children. He hugged his children. For me, that was one of the painful realities of living in his house, is I had to be hugged, which up until that time, nobody hugged in my house. So he'd chase me around and get me in a bear hug and wrestle me to the ground and make me submit into a hug. And I would scream and lose my mind and cuss and get up and stomp off. But, you know, he did teach me what appropriate physical love looked like. And I'm grateful for them. By the time I graduated, I don't even know how I graduated. I didn't want to graduate. I had a bottle of chloraseptic filled with vodka in my locker. I drank every day. The last week of school, when I was a senior, my aunt walked in on me sitting on the floor upending a bottle of hot vodka. And she just shut the door, and I could hear her walk down the hallway and say, "I cannot wait until you are out of my house." My mom had somehow filled out applications and got me enrolled into the University of Cincinnati, but I didn't want to go to school. I just wanted to drink. So I went to class sometimes. If I did, I was usually high or drunk. I flunked out of my freshman year, and somebody dared me to go into the Air Force. I went into the Air Force, and they found out that I was fraudulent on my entrance paperwork, which I was, because I had already been arrested a few times and didn't tell them. They put me in corrective custody, and they would give us like a day pass, so my roommate, cellmate, whatever, and I would go into town, change out of our dress blues, put on street clothes, hide the bag in the ceiling tiles of the Hilton across the street from where the bus let us off, and we would bar hop in San Antonio all day. Well, they caught me and threw me out. So I'm 19 years old. I've been arrested 3 times. I can't finish anything. I can barely start anything. And I'm back home with my mom. By the time I was in the Air Force, okay, this is where it starts to get good. My sister, who's younger than me, joined a group of women called the Chicago Knockers. This is back when mud wrestling was a big deal. Now, the sick part of this is the woman who ran the group was my mom's friend. My sister was only 17 years old. So she went off and did that. She had a good time. When they were at the Alaskan State Fair, somebody clotheslined her and broke her back. It was just a fracture. She could walk, but she couldn't wrestle anymore. So I'm coming out of the Air Force, and they say, "Why don't you take her place?" So I'm traveling around the country, mud wrestling with the Chicago Knockers, and having the time of my life. Okay, I was partying. There was plenty of alcohol, plenty of cocaine, and limousines, and interviews at radio stations, and the bar life, you know. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. Somewhere around there, I met my first husband. He was Canadian. He was a musician. He was playing at a rock bar in Cincinnati, Annie's. And I met him and decided I was going to move to Toronto like that. Moved to Toronto and married him, and we lived in his parents' basement. And I drank up all their alcohol, and I smoked up all their cigarettes, and was a complete mooch. Meanwhile, my sister meets up with a couple girls from Atlanta, and she moves to Atlanta. So I'm in Toronto, miserable, and she says, "Joette, you have got to get down here. You are not going to believe this city." So I jump on the Greyhound bus and go to Atlanta. And it's October, and it's already sleeting in Toronto, gray and wet and gross. And by the time I get to Atlanta, the fall foliage is on the trees. It's sunny and 70. They pick me up at the bus station and take me straight to Tattletales. So that wasn't as difficult of a transition as I thought it would be. I drank for free. I got out of there at 2 or 3 in the morning, and we flew across town to Marietta to the Rock Bar, and we went to Magruder's, and we hung out with all the cool musicians. Okay. It was fun. I was having a good time, and I didn't think there was a thing in the world wrong with it. I went to the Gold Club. I walked in there, and I'm telling you, it was like walking onto the pages of Playboy. Okay? There were celebrities everywhere. These are the most beautiful women I'd ever seen. Professional athletes, actors, musicians, everywhere, all the time. $200 bottles of champagne, money, hand over fist, and I get to drink for free. I found out that Canadian husband wouldn't work, so he had to go. And I like musicians, but I like real rock stars. Okay, so I got me one of those. Yeah, you see where this is going. Strippers and musicians, right? Okay, that's what it was. Strippers and musicians. And it was life in the fast lane. I was hanging out with the people I had been listening to on the radio since I was a kid. Greg Allman was the one who told me when I was pregnant with my first child that it would be a girl. Okay, he took his ring and a strand of my hair and did this clockwise thing. I don't even know what that was. He said, "You're having a girl, you're having a girl." And I did. It was a good time. My drinking was progressing all along, okay? When you're having fun, you really don't notice the progression, okay? And there were consequences. There were. But nothing compared to what I'd grown up with, okay? My normal was never normal. We always got our lights cut off. We always got the phone cut off. There was always an orange extension cord running from our apartment out into the outlet in the hallway of our apartment building. So when I spent my rent money on cocaine, it was no big deal. You know, when I got arrested for battery, again, no big deal. Not paying my bills was no big deal. I made cash every night. I would make the money up. And I would make it work. So a lot of people might have hit bottom faster than I did, but because I was accustomed to unmanageability, it was really all I knew. I lived like that for a long time and told you I was having fun. Okay. All right, I need to talk about what it was starting to look like. I'm having a good time, but I'm surrounded by musicians, strippers, prostitutes, drug dealers, porn stars. Okay, these are my friends. This is the life I'm living. And I'm starting to look more out of control than any of them. People are asking questions, okay? The rock star is starting to go, "God, Joette, can't you not drink?" I thought, yeah, I can not drink. So I'd go to work, and I'd try to not drink. And I would come home at 4 in the morning, brush my teeth, and wash my hair, and try to scrub the stink off, and climb into bed, and he'd go, "I thought you weren't going to drink. Can't you not drink?" And I can recall the moment I sat on the edge of bed, and I thought, I can't. I can't not drink. I'd crossed the invisible line. I remember reading an article in a magazine, the 20 questions you might be an alcoholic if. And, you know, in We Agnostics, there are two questions that matter. The 20 questions, I checked off every one of them. Check, 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 check. I outdrank any limit they had on there. And I kind of just pushed it aside. I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I thought, I'm better than that, okay? I'm a better drinker than that. So I just went ahead and pushed forward. My sister, okay, who had been partying right along with me, she was working in the same clubs, dating the same kinds of people, hanging around with the same crowd, all right along with me, partying with me, got pregnant. And her boyfriend found out she was pregnant and left. She moved in with us. And it was a lot of fun. You know, she had the baby, my boogie, my nephew, and she decided to stop drinking. And just like that, she stopped drinking. He's going to be 23 years old, and she's still not drinking. So, you know, the rock star and I are watching her, and we're like, hey, we can do that. Let's have a baby. What an idea, right? Alcoholic thinking. So I'm not drinking. I stopped drinking. And at 5 months pregnant, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. Absolutely miserable. Hair-pulling miserable. And just somebody walked up to me and said, you are a mess. You're going to hurt the baby. You're just so stressed out. Take this glass of wine. And that's what I did. I drank the glass of wine. And on page 24, and I'm going to read this because I just can't remember anything anymore. Most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So, 5 months pregnant, and I'm drinking daily. The rock star notices how much wine, so I buy 5-liter boxes. Whatever that junk was, Franzia, what was that? Okay. So he can't see how much I'm drinking. I have to tell you, I had been to AA. I'm going to back up. That's why I have the notes. Okay. Before my sister got pregnant, I'd gone to AA, and I want to tell you about the guy who 12-stepped me. All right, I'm working in a strip club, and there's a customer in the strip club. He calls himself a coke addict, but he's drunk every time I see him, and he has a breathalyzer installed in his car. He is an attorney, and he's in the process of being disbarred because he's under investigation for soliciting prostitution from a 13-year-old in Costa Rica. Okay? This is the guy who brought me to my first meeting about the heart. He took me to the Triangle Club, and I went in, and I sat there, and we got to the Lord's Prayer, and I got weirded out, and I left, and I drank that night, okay? And I continued to drink. And then, okay, another customer, all right, customer number two in a strip club, all right, notices how much trouble I'm in and invites me to another meeting, and I go to NABA. I stay sober for about 6 weeks and end up drinking again, okay? Then my sister gets pregnant. She decides to stop drinking, and she just stops drinking. She can manage the decision, and I could not. I could not manage the decision to stop drinking. I drank anyway. And that was what was going to happen. I was going to drink no matter what. And the first year of my daughter's life was absolute hell on earth. I was drinking daily, and I was starting to do things that were keeping me up nights. And I remember thinking I would never stay up all night long until I did. And I thought I would never stay up for 2 nights in a row. Who does that? Until I did. I would never stay up for 3 nights in a row. Who doesn't sleep for 3 nights in a row? Until I did. I was leaving my daughter at the babysitter for 3 days in a row. And I was dying on the inside. Every day I'd get up and beg God to keep me sober. You know, every day I'd say, please don't let me drink tonight. And every day I'd walk into that club, and within 5 minutes I'd already shot back a couple of drinks, maybe. Maybe I was knee-calling drunk before I even woke up enough to realize I had drank again. That strange mental blank spot. Okay. So I am driving around in my car feeling like I want to die. And not only do I want to die, but I don't want to leave my daughter behind. There was this twist of thought that made me think it would be cruel to leave her without a mother. So my plan was to commit suicide, but I was going to kill my daughter and then commit suicide. And man, the only time I ever have to think about that is when I'm here or doing step work with a sponsee. And I only say it because it was real to me. I drove around in my car and went through my day, and I didn't talk to anybody about it. And it was real. And that's when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. There was the day I woke up and thought, I just want to die. And then there was a thought, or I could go back to AA. And I don't know where that came from. So I got somebody to keep my daughter, and I went to a noon meeting at Easy 123. I met a lady named Nancy. She followed me home and dumped out the beer I had in my fridge. Now, without that to drink, I started to shake. Okay, by the end of that evening, I was hallucinating, sweating, throwing up on my knees. And the rock star was on the road, and I did not know that was going to happen to me. I shook for days. I hallucinated for a couple of days. But every day, Nancy came and got me and saw that my neighbor took the baby, and I went to the noon meeting. I think she was a tough old broad from Chicago, and I loved her. She brought me to that meeting, and she realized that I needed a job more than I needed a big book when I got there. I had no self-worth. I hated myself for the thoughts I was having. I was so filled with guilt, hopelessness. And she said, why don't you just stand here and make some coffee? Now, I knew how to go into a club and make a lot of money. What I didn't know how to do was be a normal person in a brightly lit room with normal people. So the coffee commitment gave me a post. It gave me a place to stand, and I didn't have to be afraid or insecure. I could do my job and not have to talk to anybody, and I felt like I got to stay. She took me through the steps until she moved away. So written first step was the first thing I did. I got to look at the, you know, levels of powerlessness in my life, and that was evident. It was the unmanageability that I was surprised about. Like I said, I had lived that way for so long. But when I started to look back and think, you know, I've been to jail a lot. I've been in a lot of fights. I have woken up naked in my own puke 3 different times. Okay? I've had 12-hour blackouts, 24-hour blackouts. And I had operated as if that was normal. She got me to step 2, and I realized that I wasn't being restored to sanity. I was being introduced to it. Like I said, she moved away, and I got a new sponsor, Daisy, and she took me through the rest of the steps. Now, when I got to step 3, I had a real problem with turning my will and my life over. You know, it wasn't that I didn't believe in a God. I wasn't agnostic or atheist. And I would have told you a long time ago that I thought God hated me. That wasn't the case. I just felt like he had let me go. That's what I came here with, an idea that he had let me go. And as I'm working on my fourth step, I look up and see a little card somebody had given me. It was the Footprints Prayer, and the rock star played golf. There were little tiny golf pencils and scorecards everywhere. I picked up the Footprints Prayer and read it for the first time, and the last line said, my precious, precious child, I love you and I would never leave you. It's when you see the one set of footprints that I carried you. And I don't know why, but that was my first spiritual experience. I felt the presence of God, and it physically knocked me out of my bed, onto my knees. I knew that he was with me. And, you know, today I work with a lot of people who call themselves atheists or agnostic, but the saddest thing is when you actually believe that God would let you go. I know today that he never let go. He has never let go of me. I made it through that fifth step and started to feel better. I got a little bit of relief, and I stopped going to my everyday meetings and stopped talking to my sponsor regularly, and started lying again. Imagine that. So I'm lying to my best friend who was in the program, and I'm lying to my sponsor, and I'm doing things that I did when I was drunk. All right. I'm not going to any more meetings, and I eventually don't want to lie to my sponsor, so I just stop calling her. And before all is said and done, I am having an affair, and I'm pregnant. And this is what I'm doing in sobriety. I flip my life upside down, okay, and put myself in a world of pain, and I still don't know how I didn't drink through that. So, rock star's out, bouncer is in. So let me tell you how this looks, okay. When the rock star and I lived together, decided we were going to have a baby, got pregnant, I had to call the Canadian and get a divorce. Then we got engaged. All right, so I get pregnant, okay, buy a house with the bouncer. Oh, I get pregnant, then break up with the rock star, then buy a house with the bouncer, and then get married. And that was the pattern of my life. I mean, everything just happening. No decisions being made. Me just going wherever my erratic behavior and my alcoholism took me. So we buy a house and move to Sugar Hill. And somehow I survive that insanity. And I go to this renting house in Sugar Hill. And I walk into the women's meeting there. And I'm about 3.5 years sober. I'd been to a women's recovery workshop, a conference, and heard a woman tell her story. And I called her and asked her if she would be my sponsor. And what she says is that was the worst talk she's ever given. That story was just her doing nothing but complaining about her ex the whole time. And she wondered how sick I had to be to think that somebody like that could have anything to give. By the grace of God, she is sponsoring me today still, 17 years later. We got busy working on the steps. And I got busy figuring out how to love women. Okay, I sat in the back room of that meeting, and I had barbs sticking out of me. My resting bitch face is heinous, okay? I'm terrifying. Ask my kids. So I'd sit there in the corner and feel this. Love me, love me, love me. Get away, get away, get away. Love me, love me, love me. Get away, get away, get away. And I'd complain. Those women aren't very nice, and I'm not going back there, and they don't like me, and they're mean to me. So the suggestion was made, and I don't know if it was her or somebody else, that I start greeting the door and introducing myself. So you better believe when I have a newcomer that I'm sponsoring, and she comes to me and complains about being uncomfortable because the women won't talk to her and they're not nice to her, I cannot wait. You say, guess what? You've got a new commitment. You can start greeting people when they come through the door. You look them in the eye, you hug them, and you introduce yourself. And that worked for me. I started to become plugged in. I told you I needed a job before I needed a big book, and that was true. And when I started going to my group conscience meetings and getting involved in service work, I feel like that's when I really, really belonged to my group. I was this alternate secretary and secretary, and then I don't even remember anymore, alternate GSR, GSR, and I started going to district and assembly, and just really enjoyed it and felt really plugged in. And I loved the inner workings of AA. I did. I was just trucking along, working the steps, working on relationships, figuring out how to just be. I want to tell you this. I stayed in the strip club for 5 years into sobriety. Okay, I don't recommend that. But I believe that money was my source. I didn't think God was my source. I believed cash was my source, and I was not going to survive without it. So for 5 years, I would go into work, and I would do my job, and I would go home, right? And I would go to meetings, and then I would go to work, I'd do my job, and go home. And I'm telling people I'm sober, and I'm wondering why nobody's asking me for advice or asking me for help, you know? And it was because I just didn't have it to give away. I just didn't have it yet. I was a sober person still acting out the way I did when I was a drunk woman. It took a long time for me to finally grow up and emotionally mature. I remember somebody telling me, I guess you'll just have to go back in there until you don't have to go back in there anymore. And that's exactly what happened. I asked God for the willingness to help me be willing. And one day I was getting ready for work. I was putting mascara on in the mirror, and I felt it. God said, "You're done. You don't ever have to go in there again." I put the mascara down, one eye of mascara, and I went and told my husband, "I'm not going in tonight." And he goes, "You mean tonight?" Okay. I said, "No, I mean ever." He was like, "What? Joette, we just bought this house. What do you mean?" And I said, "I'm sorry. God's going to work it out." And I never went back again. Just like that. I didn't have to stress or strain. I just believed. God asked me to do it. I did it, and I believed He'd provide, and He has. My sister did that same thing. She wasn't in recovery, but she stayed in that club for a long time. She was a single mom. And just one day, she decided, "I don't have to go back in there ever again." And she didn't. I did get a job in a human resources department. Now, I didn't know how to have a real job or a straight job or whatever you call it, you know. And I needed a lot of help and a lot of prayer. My best friend helped me get the job. It was just, just an admin job. And to my surprise, the program had kicked in enough in my life, and I had been practicing these principles long enough that I didn't steal from them anything, ever. I never stole a thing from them. I was on time. I was competent. I was as surprised as anyone, okay? They gave me a key to the building and a credit card. I'll never forget how I felt when they handed me that credit card. I was like, "Are you out of your mind?" One of my greatest financial amends, the rock star, when we were splitting up, tried to be altruistic in the knight in shining armor, and he said, "Well, just in case, here's a credit card. Use this for emergencies only, okay?" So I go out and run up about, $5,000 or $7,000 worth of debt in about 3 weeks on that thing. Okay, one of the things I did was buy a new mattress for me and my new boyfriend. I got busy paying that one off once I got sober, okay? And once I started with the financial amends, and I did pay it off every dime. And I'll tell you, many years later, probably 10 years later or so, we got into a big argument about something, and he threw that in my face. And I can't tell you how good it felt for me to say, "I paid that back. Every dime of it. I don't owe you a thing. I have never asked you for anything from that day on either." I'm so grateful that I could say that and not be a slave to my bad behavior for the rest of my life. About 10 years sober, I was just trucking along. You know, my life was starting to look like a normal life. I had two daughters, beautiful daughters, okay? I was volunteering in the community. I was volunteering at church. I was volunteering in their classrooms. My little girl was in kindergarten, and the kids in that class loved me. They'd say, "Mrs. Reese's mommy. Mrs. Reese's mommy," whenever they'd see me. And I'd read to them, and they loved me, and it was so much fun. I had my church does these things called small groups, and they're like Bible studies, and I was hosting Bible studies in my house. And I felt really good about the way life was going. And then I found out that my husband was addicted to opiates, and that he had been having an affair. He wanted a separation, and he moved out. And I have to tell you, I had to get to this place where I realized there was a whole new level of powerlessness. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I conceded to my innermost self, "I'm an alcoholic." But I didn't know how powerless I was over people. until this point. Now, I heard this last weekend at a traditions workshop, and I want to thank Barbara A. for reading these, and I'm going to steal them from her, because this perfectly describes the condition I was in. My husband moved out, and I went crazy. Okay? So these are the Al-Anon precepts. 1, I was powerful over others, and your lives were unmanageable. 2, I came to believe that I was the power that could restore you to sanity. 3, made a decision that you should turn your will and your life over to my care. 4, made a searching and fear-filled inventory of everyone that I knew and found them lacking. 5, admitted to God and anyone that would listen the exact nature of your wrongs. 6, became entirely ready to assist you in removing all your defects of character. 7, humbly assisted you in removing your defects of character, except when to do so would cause me harm. 8, made a list of all persons that had harmed me and vowed to get even with them all. Didn't I? You remember. 9, waited for everyone to make direct amends to me. 10, continued to take your inventory, and when you were wrong, promptly pointed it out. 11, sought through martyrdom, managing, mothering, and manipulating to improve your conscious contact with me, asking only that you read my mind and carry out my wishes. 10, some of you remember this, but having a complete physical, spiritual, and emotional breakdown as the result of this type of living, I tried to drag all those I love down with me and get sympathy and pity from anyone who would listen. I ended up getting arrested for battery, 10 years sober. I was absolutely out of control again. The powerlessness and unmanageability in my life were destroying the people I loved for one reason. I could not let go. I could not believe that a loving God would want me to get another divorce, that would want to drag my children through another broken home. I believed he was for marriage. And I was going to fix this guy and make him act right, and God was going to save this family. And for 3 years, I lost my mind around that thing. The day I walked out of jail, I signed the divorce papers, and I let go. I got back busy with my sponsor on an inventory of my behavior. Now, this guy was having an affair and addicted to pills, and I can't even begin to tell you the levels of degradation he brought our family to, okay, the chaos. And I would not look at that. I had to look at me. I had to look at what I did. I did the inventory. I let go. I took a $5,000 loan out of my 401k. I got myself a townhouse, and I moved myself and my girls out. We had 3 homes now that they lived in, all 3 homes. I had a lot of time by myself. And this is when I realized that I had put my reliance on people, okay, on money, on my job, on your celebrity, whatever it was I could identify myself with, okay? And God was just like knocking down all of those things one at a time. The Rockstar and I had maintained a very good friendship. For the last 10 years, we had all been together. We went on family vacations together. We did birthdays together. The bouncer and I and the girls spent the night at his house so the girls could wake up on Christmas morning and we could all be together. You know, that it worked well for 10 years. And he started dating somebody new and it didn't work for her. And rather than just accept the fact that it just didn't work for her and I should just let that happen, I just got so caught up in this Al-Anon insanity. The good news is I did go to an Al-Anon meeting, and I got an Al-Anon sponsor, and I started working the Al-Anon steps. And I tell you all that because there's a story that happened with Reese, my younger daughter, that reminds me so much of my behavior. Now, this kid doesn't like needles, doesn't like sharp things. Okay, when she was like 3, she had to get her blood drawn, and the nurse missed her finger stick. And I saw it happen as if it were in slow motion, because I knew, okay. It took 3 or 4 grown people to get that 3-year-old to get that tiny little finger back out there so they could stick her again. They had her legs, her arms, she's thrashing and rolling her head back, okay. The other thing that you can't do besides stick her is hold her down. She, for whatever reason, cannot be restrained. I had a therapist tell me when she was throwing these terrible tantrums, why don't you just try holding her real tightly? Sit on the floor and wrap your legs around her. I tried it. Not a good idea. That was no bueno, okay? She just went into another dimension, threw her head back, eyes rolled back in her head. What I had to do was just let her spin. Her head against the wall, kick her feet. She'd do that for about 20 minutes, and when she was done, she kind of came to. She'd be all sweaty and wet and red, and she'd just look around like she didn't even know where she'd been. She'd crawl into my lap and just sob on my shoulder. Okay, this is how that resolved itself. Well, all right, so fast forward to the first grade. A little boy throws a rock at her, and I get a call, and they say, you're going to need to come get Reese. I think she needs stitches. So I call my best friend, I'm on the phone praying the whole way there. I get there and she's got a big gash right here, this beautiful little girl. They cleaned her up pretty good and she was pretty calm. I realized nobody had mentioned the stitches yet, okay? So I get her out of there, I put her in the booster seat behind me and I head out, all right? And she's like, are we going home? I said, no baby, we gotta go to the doctor. Why? I said, honey, you're going to need to get that looked at. I think you're going to need stitches. And the scream that came out of her mouth. No! No, I don't want stitches. I don't want a shock. So she called them shocks. Don't make me do it. I'm trying to be calm. I'm saying, honey, that's going to leave a scar. It's going to get infected. If there was any other way, okay, I wouldn't do this. You know I wouldn't do this. No, and she starts kicking the back of my chair, and she's thrashing. If you love me, you wouldn't make me do this. You wouldn't let them give me stitches, and you don't love me. And she's screaming the entire way to the emergency room. And I kept thinking I would do anything if I didn't have to put her through this. But I have to, because I love her. I love her, and this is necessary. And she'll be better off on the other side of it. Once I get there, they try to numb it, but she won't hold still. Okay, and they're like, we'll give her some time to calm down. So they wait an hour, a little more, and she's not calming down. All right. The nurse finally comes in and says, we can't wait any longer. We're going to have to tie her down to the papoose. And my heart sunk. Oh, God. This just went from bad to worse. So I asked him to leave the room. And I just grabbed her by her shoulders and made her look in my eyes. And I said, listen, they're going to tie you down. You've got to let mommy hold you. And it was as if she heard me. She said, okay, mommy. So they came in and I leaned her over and she's laying on the thing and I'm like on her like this, you know, with my weight kind of on her arms because I expected her to just thrash again, right? And what I forgot was my sponsor had given me a necklace that she values and cherishes and wears every day. She probably has it on right now while I was going through the divorce. It was to give me strength and remind me to pray and remind me that I was not alone. So as I leaned over Reese, I could see her little bitty hand grab the necklace and hold it. And she held still while they tugged and put 6 stitches in that gash, and we made it through it. It was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. But when I think about how much God loves me, and how going through that breakup and that divorce and all of that experience, it was just him saying, Joette, this is not for you, okay? I've got something better. This is good for you. You're going to have to trust me. If I could have just let go sooner and just trusted him. I did a lot of damage to my children during that time. I wasn't an abusive parent. But during that time, I was so filled with fear, and my old friend's rationalization and justification popped up, and character defects that I hadn't seen in a while. Rage, self-pity, victimization. Somehow, I had gotten so much fear, I thought my kids were going to choose to live anywhere but with me. And that fear enough was enough for me to just act out and say, you know what, get out of my house then. And I wrecked my then 14-year-old. And I think of what I went through when I was a kid. And for her to be wrecked, just those words from my mouth, it was enough to wreck. It just escalated from there. We got into a physical thing. She wouldn't come when I called her. I was already so angry, and I grabbed her by her hair and jerked her across the porch. And life went straight to hell in a handbasket because I just didn't trust God. I couldn't trust Him. Like I said, I went to jail. I hit a bottom with that. And I've heard Beth H. say this, that hitting bottom is when you can't lower your standards fast enough to keep up with your behavior. That was true for me when I was drinking as well in my sobriety. So I get busy, okay? We got our own place, and I get busy searching for God, right? And I'm on my face every day. I don't have a job. I lost my job. My dog died. My grandmother died. I lost my friend, the rock star, and my marriage. And I was alone. I had a ton of time on my hands, so I woke up every day. I spent about 2 hours in prayer and meditation. I was going to two or three meetings a day, and I started picking up sponsees. And that was my salvation. Walking through the steps with these women saved me. It helped me to see who I was and what I was and what I had become and what I wanted to be. They seemed to be seeking a God, and they were looking to me to help them find it. So it was really just a matter of us walking together, finding God. And He revealed Himself to me. I have to tell you, if you seek, you'll find. I had to cast away all the things that I had depended on and put my reliance on God, on a loving God who is for me. I realized that I was picking the wrong men. Okay, I had a real broke picker, right? So I tell God, I make a pact, I'm not going to date anymore, I'm just going to be single. And I did this on my floor in my apartment. I said, I'm going to be single for 6 months. Never done that, okay? And I did that. And 6 months went so well that I did it for six more months. And that went so well, I stayed single for another year. And then almost another year after that. What I did was work through the sex inventory and then the sex ideal. Okay? And the ideal was not so much about Mr. Right or finding the guy, you know, the perfect guy for me. It was about who I wanted to be, who I wanted to show up as in a relationship. And when I did start dating, I made some mistakes, picked the wrong people again. I discovered my ego makes me want things that are bad for me. Always Charlie. Charlie B, everybody. Always have a hanky. Charlie gave me a hanky at my wedding recently. You know, shortly after I started dating again, I met my husband Michael at church, okay? Now, I'd never noticed him before, but there's this guy standing out in front of church greeting. He's the guy that runs out to your car when it's raining with an umbrella and walks you in and then runs back out to the parking lot with another umbrella and walks that person in. He's always out there smiling. And he was a nice guy. And I didn't want to go out with anybody. I'd met him right when I was just recently had decided I wasn't going to date. So I said, no, I'm not dating. And time goes by, years go by, and eventually 5 years go by. And I stop going to the church. I date somebody else. He's dating other people. We break up with them and then come back together in 5 years' time. And there he was. And he's like, so, can I call you? Because you told me I could call you before, and you never answer your phone. I said, yeah, go ahead and call me. Okay, you can call me. So there was a day that my daughter had a volleyball. She played volleyball, and it was the state championship, and it was a beautiful sunny Saturday, and they left, and they go, oh, by the way, Mom, we know it was your Saturday, but the rock star's new wife planned family pictures for this day, on my day. So they leave, and I'm sitting in my car full of self-pity, and I want to reach out for the thing that's going to make me feel better, so I'm going to text this guy. I can't wait anymore for him to call me. I start texting, hey, you want to go to a movie? And I realize, nope, I'm not going to pursue him. My ego makes me want things that are bad for me. I'm going to wait for the guy that pursues me. So I delete the entire text, put the phone in my purse, and go home, and I lay down to take a nap. And no sooner did I lay down to take the nap did I get a text. And it was Michael. You want to get something to eat? I bounced out of that bed. I was like, yes! So, meet him for dinner, and then the next night I go meet him at his house, and he makes dinner, and it was then that I knew that I had been a very stupid woman, and I had wasted a lot of time. This guy, okay, was the guy that God chose for me, not the one that I chose for me. There are things about him that are so perfect for me that wouldn't be perfect for anybody else. Remember the German farm people that I told you about? The good people, the hardworking guys? It's him. High integrity guy. He does what he says he's going to do. Complete transparency in our home. It's one of the things I was so afraid to go back into another relationship. I just didn't think I could trust anybody. So I let him know I just need a level of transparency. And he's like, whatever you need. And it saved me. Today we have an amazing life. My daughters are 21 and 17. My youngest will be leaving next year for college. And they're great kids. They're great kids. I currently have a service commitment at my group. Me and Scott and Cheryl meet every other Monday, and we clean the Serenity House. And it's my favorite commitment in 20 years. It is the best thing I've ever done for AA. Alcoholics can get coffee on everything, okay? You're worse than my kids. I sponsor some of the most amazing women. And I'll tell you, sponsoring can be terrifying, but we do it for us, right? I do it to stay sober, so I know that. And I get one or two sponsors and start working through the steps, and it's time intensive, and then somebody else asks me to sponsor them, and I think, God, I can't. And then somebody else asks me to sponsor them, and I'm like, God, I don't know if I have enough time or the ability to do this. But what I found, and the other thing is I love them. Like each new sponsee, I think I love her so much, there's not any more room in my heart to love any more people. Okay? And then I start working with the new woman, and it's like, I love her so much. There's no more room in my heart. Somebody else calls, and they're like, I need help. And I'm like, okay, come on over. And I love her so much. And I just found that God just increases my capacity to love. I want to always say yes to AA. You know, there's not a road that gets you from where I came from to this podium. There's no road. But my good friend Shauna put this in my 20th AA birthday gift card. And I want to read it to you. There exists a mystic power that is able to transform your life so thoroughly, so radically, so completely, that when the process is completed, your own friends would hardly recognize you. And in fact, you would scarcely be able to recognize yourself. This power can do for you that which is probably the most important thing of all in your present stage. It can find your true place in life for you and put you in it. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a blast. I'm glad it's over. Have a great weekend.